This Week in Mormons, coming to you. Hey, This Week in Mormons, what we say is true. We're bringing you the love from The View.
We're bringing you the love from The View.
I never said
that was great.
I never said improvisational song was my strength. Wayne Brady's not here. If I had him, this would be excellent.
Oh my gosh, what a handsome man that Wayne Brady.
Or for that matter,
and his teeth are so white.
Or Chip Heston. And I'm going to see Chip Heston
no,
this
Chip's
weekend.
The worst. Ryan Stiles. Now we're talking.
Do you know Chip Heston?
Yes.
You ever Chip watched Heston. Him on the great show Nashville?
No.
He.
I would not.
The
do
man
that.
Deserves an Emmy.
One, because Nashville's not a great show. Two, because I don't like Chip Heston.
Nashville's an okay show, and Chip Heston is almost on my list of men who I wish were my father if my father was not my father.
Oh my. Well, that's
he's
bold.
A beautiful man. Okay. Well, other men are on there. Have been on there in the past. Phil Collins, Alton Brown. You know, my father-in-law.
All of these men have made the list.
I mean, I love you, Craig. You're the best one.
My father.
So, anyway, I'm going to Nashville this weekend. It's going to be very exciting. Can't wait.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's nice to finally do something exciting. Since you're married, that doesn't happen very often.
And Chip Heston.
I hope you take your journal.
Chip I take my journal everywhere because I write in it all the time.
Attaboy.
And Chip will be performing. I will be there lifting my shirt up.
Will you really? Will you really go and see him perform?
Yeah, no, it's the thing. My wife's got a conference, and he's performing at it, and we're going. This is real. This was almost a driving factor in us deciding
fun.
We wanted to go to it. If this,
well, cool. I'm glad that you're doing something interesting, Jeff.
Thanks, Al.
Speaking of which, did you do anything interesting this week?
Let me tell you about a show called Dawson's Creek.
It's
the lamest program ever made. Dawson.
You've been watching Dawson?
I don't know how this happened. The other night, we just like got some pizza, and we're just looking on Netflix and just put Dawson's Creek on for no reason. And we watched like five episodes.
No.
And by the end, all I want to do is strangle Dawson all the time.
I remember a fireside warning against the dangers of Dawson Creek as a child because it portrayed teenagers having sex, which you are so against, Jeff.
And actually, it's a fair point. Remember, I went on a rant last week about Friends? Dawson Creek, I mean, the thing is, it's even more dangerous because it was a show designed to appeal to teenagers.
If I may, the mere fact that you're a grown man that's watching Dawson's Creek.
I don't know if I'd say watching, like use the active gerund to describe my experience with Dawson's Creek.
We watched like five episodes, end quote.
Yeah, but I don't know if I see myself making it through six seasons.
I'm half an episode every week of West Wing, a show for grown-ups.
I've already watched that
you
show.
Can't,
I've seen it.
You can't watch Dawson's Creek, Jeff. That's just not okay.
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's going to – I'm going to follow through on it. I don't think it's going to keep going.
Don't you remember in like the third episode, the guy has sex with his teacher? That was scandalous.
I know. It's a messed up program. I'm ashamed. Too shame.
Yeah, what are you going to do next? Melrose Place? Is that coming up?
90210, buddy.
90210. The most incestual teenage program
of all
time.
That's all I'm going to watch. One Tree Hill will come after that eventually.
Meet me at the Peach Pit, Jeff. Meet me at the Peach Pit.
More importantly, do you know what the Peach Pit becomes later on at nighttime? It's called the Peach Pit After Dark, and it's a nightclub. Because people convert diners into nightclubs in reality.
Wait, is that a real
thing?
That's
what happened on the show. Avada Kedavra.
Oh. You're ridiculous. You're a ridiculous man that watches trashy, trashy teenage TV programs.
Let the record show that Alan Doane's favorite television program is news radio, and his favorite band is Cake. I always like that.
Yeah, because I'm a classy man with classy taste.
I like to read.
My life is dope, and I do dope things.
Tell me more about any other dope things going on in your life, Al.
Yeah, I had exciting things happen all the time.
Really?
All
like what?
Of the time. I have a birthday coming up.
Yeah, I know.
Tomorrow.
This is your birthday episode.
Hello, everybody. It's very exciting. I have all of my partners have flown in for our big training this week. That's exciting. We open a restaurant tomorrow night or Friday night. So I'm opening a new restaurant. I mean, I'm doing
meaningful
things.
You scheduled a big training
life,
on your birthday.
Like.
That's you know.
Yeah, I sure
you
did.
Shouldn't do that. That's foolish.
It was one time. What can you do? I can't know everything.
Well, Al, it's a big year. You turned 30 this year.
29, Jeff.
That's
29
what I mean.
Again.
29.
Hey-o! Now I'm like the old woman.
Aha!
You should be the lawyer.
I am the lawyer. Speaking of lawyers, allegedly Arrested Development season 5 is actually going to happen.
You didn't even like the rest of season 4.
I know, but the thing I read with some of the people behind the scenes acknowledged that they realized the way they tried to do it resulted in a weaker show. So I think if they go forward on a season 5, they're going to try to do it the way it should be done.
Okay.
I just broke this news.
Okay, good.
It's going to be good.
It's going to be good.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what's going on.
I did get assigned. I got assigned to give a talk this week. I'm very excited. It's on...
What's your topic?
Testimony, the difference between belief, hope, and knowing.
Hope. I didn't realize hope. I like that. Now, did they give you this topic?
They gave me this that's topic. I was like, all right.
I think that's actually a really good topic. I think in the church, very often, especially with testimonies and stuff, don't we almost stigmatize it if somebody were to go up there and just say, I believe that the Book of Mormon is true. And you'd be like, wait a minute. We say we know.
I remember there was a member of the 12 or somebody like that that was, they got up and said, I believe that this is true. And somebody was like, whoa. And he's like, no, it's okay. I can believe. I don't yet know.
It's a good topic.
It's interesting because I think oftentimes like there's a stigma. There is a stigma around like get to I know. Say I know. And for a long time I actually really wanted to my older brother was struggling with his membership in the church. And for a long time I really wanted like that the big grand, you know, I was like, God, show me an angel, huh? Give me something like that where I can go to him and I can say, dude, you know me. No, like this happened. It was there. Give me that. And, it was interesting because as soon as I would have had that, I would have gone to him and then his belief would have been in me instead of in, you know, the Holy Ghost or in God. Like it wouldn't have helped him anyway. But I really wanted that. I really wanted that thing where I could say that and be like, I know for real, like, even if I had to be coy, I'd be like, yeah, and then I'll just say I know and wink at him, and he'll know that I know. But instead, I'm stuck saying, like, I prayed really hard, I've had great experiences that say this, and I have a very strong belief, and I mean, there's little room for doubt in me, but the difference between belief and knowledge, I feel like there's still a chasm there. And I don't know, I mean, can you think of any examples or stories that I could use to sort of illustrate some of that? Because that's sort of where I'm at, where I'm like I teach much better using sort of the parables, the analogies, that kind of thing. And I'm trying to think of an angle that like articulates that, and I can't.
Let's see. I'm thinking of this. As a side note, this is a great opportunity to crowdsource. So if you have ideas and you're listening
people.
And you're big about this topic,
hey,
send us an email at contact@thisweekinmormons.com.
Email. Send it to Zoom. Z-mail.
You have a Zune? Yeah, they don't make
that's
Zune.
From, that's from
Didn't
PBS.
You have a Zune once?
No, I had a Big Al's Big Feet at Bigfoot.com. I thought that was clever.
Yeah, Al's the kind of guy who just buys domain names just to laugh and never do anything with them. It's like I've got $12 to waste.
I enjoyed it.
Let's think. Any good anecdotes or stories from the scriptures about belief versus a firm knowledge? It's broader, but I was, you know, I've been reading through 3 Nephi 11 and on, actually, this week. And even before that, and I feel like a lot of the Nephites, they might have had a testimony of things, but they had to really have a belief that Christ would actually come. I think it's one thing to have a belief, as we do today, or a knowledge that he did come and that he completed these things. But imagine having faith that the atonement was going to happen, which I think is a different way of looking at it. And I view that personally as harder to have a knowledge of because you can't experience the full effects of it because it has not been affected yet, basically.
I was thinking about, like in Hebrews, it talks about how, you know, you repent. You repent so that you can approach the throne of God with confidence is the verbiage that you use.
That's a good one.
Right? Like as you... you know, as you become more worthy, you gain more confidence in your relationship with God, and sort of that expectation for interaction can increase. And I'm kind of stewing on something around that of just like, of our confidence there. And it's interesting as I think back on my own testimony of like my how I bear my testimony of the restoration of the gospel. The words are the same as when I was 8 years old, right? I mean, Joseph Smith went into a grove of trees, prayed, and he saw God the Father and Jesus Christ, right? Like, those words are all we have to express that testimony. We can say, I believe, I really believe, I super believe, I mean, to the point of, I know that this happened, all of those are fine. But, like, the meaning that I believe that this happened as for me as an 8 year old, and the meaning of it is, for me is like a return missionary, or me teaching it after I've come to know for myself more and more, or come to believe, or however you want to put it. I don't know. I feel like in the church we need to be a little bit more open to the idea of belief, yeah, being meaningful, or as meaningful as
no,
as what we're trying to get to, right?
Well, because just going up, and I hate to sound cynical, and I might be totally wrong, you know, like if kids go up and bear their testimony,
yeah, the 6 year old,
I know the church is true. Now, that's not to say
it feels brainwashy. It does.
It does. And we've talked about this before from my experience teaching primary. It really made me ponder, like, where's this line between me teaching them and me brainwashing them? But at the same time, I have also seen with kids big time that the veil is thinner. Definitely. I always saw such a purity in the kids that they could so easily sense things and accept things. Al, you left.
No, it's I was open. Just going and getting some food to eat.
But yeah, but either way, though, when you see those kids say, I know, I'm like, well, you're not at the age of accountability. Do you know? Have you studied this out? Have you done all the things that we're supposed to do to gain a testimony? And
to that point, though, their knowledge is simple.
It is. That's
man.
What I'm saying. They haven't muddled it up with all of our adult thinking at that point. Honestly, I envy the kids.
It's like a 15-year-old saying, I love you. It's not the same as a 30-year-old's I love you, but it's still I love you.
It's a good way to look at
it. You know?
Yeah. And so, I don't know, it's different. How do you think you want to work in the hope angle then? If you've got hope, belief, knowledge.
I think it's different levels, right? Like, what I remember as an EFY counselor, I would start off our testimony meetings with like, hey, come on up here and talk about what you believe, talk about what you want to believe, or talk about what you know. I mean, any of those are acceptable things to bear your testimony of, right? Like there's nothing that says I can only testify of the things that I've seen. I mean, a lot of the testimonies talk about things that you're working to understand more. So, I mean, like, get up there and try and verbalize it, articulate it, and see how it feels, right? Like, let that be an indicator.
Well, that's a big part of it. I've seen many who have been, especially people who are disillusioned at times, I've seen many people call into question President Packer's counsel, you know, that says a testimony is found in the bearing of it. I'm paraphrasing, but I'm sure you've heard the same one. But I found that to absolutely be true. And I think our mission president even challenged us in that same regard, because it's very easy to doubt oneself, to doubt one's own belief, to doubt one's own knowledge and perceive just a lack of knowledge and say, how can I testify to these things? I don't know these things. These are things that are good, but I don't know anything. But I did find, as I would sit there and testify of the truths that I felt, that I believed even, and what I did know, I would feel the Spirit build upon those things. It's very interesting because it requires a great degree of faith, I think, to sort of go out on that limb and express one's sincere feelings on a matter, regardless of how it's going to be perceived, and really take that risk and hope that the Lord is going to confirm some things. Because you might have doubts. You believe, but you might have doubt.
What's interesting about that is, in my experience, I've had both good and bad there, right? Where, like, as I'm talking about it, or as I'm talking about something, I've very likely to feel that sort of foreboding of like, this isn't making sense. I don't actually, this isn't me. Right. And I'll like withdraw a little bit. And so in that same vein, like, I just feel like verbalizing and talking through something, sort of lets you internalize it and either recognize it for good or for bad. So feel free to go and try and talk through some of these things that you're believing, or that you want to believe, or whatever it is.
I hope you are able to sort of talk about destigmatizing the knowing versus believing relationship.
It's pretty much going to be like, like a 15-minute advertisement for This Week in
Marvel. Okay, that sounds good too. I'm just glad they gave you a topic. There's nothing I can't stand it in sacrament meeting when talks are based on conference talks. And it's so it's so common, and that even comes down officially, and it's fine. But whenever that happens, I get it because they're trying to reinforce what we're taught from modern day leaders. Understand?
But they end up just quoting or reading.
That's
the
problem.
Talk.
All people do.
And then he said this. That was
like
cool.
Then Elder so and so goes on to say, because I even preparing talks myself, the most rewarding experiences I've had have been when I've been given a topic, like you have, Al, and maybe that topic was culled from a particular passage of scripture where it says something, right? And they say, well, that highlights a topic. Build something around that. And I have, those are always better conference talks and not conference talks, general, now I'm still saying conference, sacrament meeting talks.
You're the best.
No, but there have been good ones, but I would love to understand more of why we so insistently push general conference talks in sacrament meeting rather than allowing the saints to perhaps develop even more. Because I think you could develop it from a conference talk, but I believe doing it that way makes it too easy to default as a talk giver if you don't really care to just sort of rehashing the talk. And then it's like, well, what was the point of all of this? What are you eating?
No, I got a bad orange there. That's my bad. Anyway, we need to move on, Jeff. We don't have much time this week.
Al, we could talk about just this all week for the whole show. I don't even care.
Yeah, I'm a busy man. I got places to go. I literally, even though this is our podcast, I'm on a time constraint.
No, people have commented before and said, why do you say you're running out of time? You have all the time in the world, which is true. We can make a...
No, screw you, listeners. We don't have all the time in the world. And while I'm on the topic, if I want to talk about Jeff's sex life, I will.
No.
Screw you, guy that didn't like me talking about Jeff's sex life.
You...
It's coming up whenever I dang well please.
I demand an apology.
It will never happen.
I demand.
I am not sorry.
I demand the apology.
I hereby do not give said apology, Jeff.
I will sit here.
You can accept my resignation.
You must apologize
demand.
For breaching the realms of propriety.
They don't exist in my world. There is no
and
realm of propriety.
That's why you're not married.
That's actually probably true. But I'm happily so.
We are.
Happily.
We're getting to the real issues here. We're going to do a therapy session.
I enjoy my obstinate approach to life. It makes me feel like more of a man.
That's very nice. It's funny that I love it when you act this way, because then I remember I've said this before. When I was out hanging out with you guys a couple years ago out there in Missouri, and how your normal Al personality, but then the way you treat your mom and your sisters is like nothing I've ever seen with the way you react to people. Because instead, it's like this total 180, and you're just like,
wait, what are you talking about?
You're fun and stuff, but no, it's a good thing. Like I liked it because I saw like when you be around your family and your sisters and everybody, you just be like, oh, hey, like, all right, well, I love you. I love you a lot. Oh, yeah, great. Just like hugs and love all around and warm fuzzies.
That's who I am, Jeff.
Well, that's who you are to them.
Are you suggesting I have a hard candy shell?
I'm suggesting that I would love to be the recipient of the warm fuzzies.
Screw you, Jeff, and our listener that hates sex. That guy's in a bad place. It's like a dark world for him.
So, anywho, I'm gonna jump into a couple things.
You can't save this, Jeff. This is my rant for the week.
We haven't done the old rant segments for a while.
So let's see. We got. Some
I'm
going
to mention a quickie right here, because if anyone's in the Salt Lake Valley, I hope you go to this on Saturday.
No, don't
on
go.
Saturday the 9th. A group is hosting a Latter Day Expo from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the South Town Expo Center in Sandy, and it's
also on Saturday the 9th. Bill Cosby is performing in St. Louis. You pick which one you'd rather.
Man,
be
I'm
at.
Never where the people are when I need to be there. I'm going to St. Louis in October. I'd love to see him then. Anyway,
dude, I'd love to see the cause, man.
For only $8 or pre-order of $6, you can go to this Latter-day Saint Expo, the first ever Mormon con, if you will.
What do you do? Dress up as a missionary?
I would pay so much money to watch this. Incidentally, I'm looking at their webpage, and I'm pretty sure I just saw this exact free WordPress template like yesterday.
You love free WordPress templates.
I don't pay for one.
All
what
right,
is the Latter-day Expo? It's a video, which I'm not going to watch. Point is, people,
there is an...
everyone needs to go.
You're still on that. Go ahead.
That's all. Going. Peggy Fletcher Stack said so. So,
Peggy Fletcher Stack cares about MormonCon. Way to go, PFS. Way to go. The there's an interesting article that actually merits some discussion on the church leadership and the dilemma of dementia.
There's a dilemma with dementia?
As a lot of you know, there's sort of a some conversations that go around Thomas S. Monson and him struggling with some of his short-term memory retention.
Uh-huh.
So, therefore, there's reason to have a discussion around what dementia and its effects on church leadership look like, right? Or people in high positions and stuff. The system, as it's put in place, is that when the Lord no longer wants you in a position of leadership, he will kill you off. That's true.
Uh-huh.
That's the model, right? That's the whole thing. We are supposed to just, you're there till you die. The idea, I remember in the RLDS church, their prophet resigned a couple of years ago. And a new one went in. That was so bizarre to me that he would be like, no, you know what? I had like 8 years of profiting and I'm good. I'm going to retire and spend some time with my family. That's where I want to be. And in our church, it's great because you're called in. You're called in for life. They're like, all right, this is the rest of what you do. You're here until you die. So with that calling or sort of that expectation, what do you do with a man whose mental health maybe isn't there? Like Gordon B. Hinckley, I feel like we were really blessed because that guy was sharp, and and he got super old, and
he got physically slower near the end. But yeah, he was still pretty there.
Yeah, but he was still. I mean, he was still like he was the armchair quarterback. I bet he could have sat in that sofa and just been like, "You there? Hey, rip, go." So now, like I remember growing up, just like it talks about in this article. There was a mention of Elder Ezra Taft Benson. And Ezra Taft Benson wasn't at, like, his last four or five general conferences.
Yeah, there was a long stretch there when he wasn't there. Yeah.
Sick, and they suggest that he wasn't there because he was suffering from dementia. Or from, you know, he was just having some health problems, or he wasn't as sharp as he used to be. And the suggestion, like, from a church policy standpoint, is that then the first presidency, that's why you have a first presidency, sort of pick up the slack, which I remember being the case with Elder Benson, where, who was it at the time, Elder Eyring?
No. When President Benson wasn't well, I believe his counsel.
Who were his counselors?
His counselors were President Hinckley and President Monson.
Oh, that's right.
And President Hinckley basically ran the church for much longer than just his formal presidency.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, well, because he took care of it, or he took care of... Elder Benson, and then Elder Hunter as well.
President. These are presidents. I mean, they were, my goodness.
President. You've been watching The West Wing too. That's President Bartlett to you. Yeah, so like the first presidency takes care of it. And by and large, I think that's a fine model. I mean, you're sort of caring for these gentlemen as they, or these brothers as they get older. And, you know, if their faculties do not sustain, you revere and love them and make them as comfortable as you can and then keep going running the church,
uh-huh.
Right? Is that sort of how it's supposed to work, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, that's just how it has to be. When prophets have been infirm, they've just taken care of what they can do.
Should there be a cord to pull, so to speak, that gets you out of there if you have mental health issues?
Well, that's what this article is arguing, that in theory the prophet would be relieved of his duties and the keys of the church would just devolve back to the 12, just like they do when the prophet dies. Except I'm assuming the 12 would just jointly retain those keys until the moment the prophet actually passed away, at which point they would ordain the next one. That's my assumption anyway. I don't know. It's interesting because of course you can see President Monson is, at moments, you can tell he looks a little bewildered. He's almost always got his handler with him now or his daughter to kind of walk him around and make sure he knows what he's doing. But that said, oh, and I'll even see him if he kind of gets off of his teleprompter. Sometimes he might look a little lost. But what I've noticed very clearly is when he gets into prophet mode and he testifies of truths and gives very direct counsel, he is extremely lucid, and that speaks very much, I think, to the power that is given to prophets. And it's true, because you can look through scriptures and a lot is physically demanded of the prophets. I don't think you have tons of examples in the scriptures, tons of when the prophet is physically incapable of exercising the affairs.
Well, like,
of the
let's
office.
Look at Moses, right? And he had Aaron and Ur on either side to hold his hands up. I mean, like,
well, yeah, but that was because he was tired. Because who's going to want to hold their hands up for like hours on end? That was, I mean, that was the main reason.
That's what getting old is, Jeff.
No, that was because he had to hold them up while they were fighting.
He was getting tired.
Al, I want you to hold your hands above your head for the remainder of this podcast, and we'll see how long you last.
I've done this lesson before. Jeff, I'm saying that getting tired and growing old are very
similar. In many ways they are. But it's true, I don't think there's a lot of scriptural precedent for a prophet just being too worn out, and then someone else just does the job. But I've seen it's very interesting when the prophets are in their mode. Yeah. And to see the way it works. Obviously, I'm not one in any situation to speak of whether we should devolve competencies back to the 12. And I think even if a prophet is infirm in one way or another. Yes. Al's wearing now Google Glass and a pair of Oakleys, it seems. He's really just bringing...
No, I have a Google Glass lens.
Every level to this. So, what was I saying? Point it.
I wish you wouldn't comment on my... wardrobe. I'm one of those guys where as I clean up, I just put on what I
oh,
find.
Oh, sure.
So I end up wearing a cape and four pair of basketball shorts and
makes perfect sense.
Underwear on my head. That's just what
there
happens.
We go. Anyway, yeah, of course, so we revere the prophet. I think it's very important that the prophet holds the keys. And that's something, remember, the other 14 men are still prophets, seers, and revelators. And they are authorized to manage the affairs of the kingdom. I think the main qualifier here really is that the prophet can receive revelation for the entire church, but even more importantly, that he holds the keys that are then devolved down to others in order to run the affairs of the church. And those keys are still held even if he's mentally impaired, so a lot of the other affairs of the church can still go on. There's a reason why we have the rest as prophets, seers, and revelators.
The one comment in this article I think is interesting, and she says, if I were President Monson's daughter, I would take him home, provide him with both the familial and expert care that he requires, and I would listen quietly and privately to his stories of long ago and laugh at his funny ways with a tear in my eye for the soaring capacities he once had. You know, just the idea that there's a lot of pressure and expectation placed on him that maybe is certainly tough to deal with, especially if the capacity is waning. In this case, like, I would fully expect that that's exactly what happens, honestly.
Yeah.
I would feel like most days, they probably don't mind if he doesn't come in until 10 and goes home at 2, right? Like they start to shift that load without being asked, I would guess. And you look at, I mean, the very capable people of Elder Uchtdorf and Elder Eyring, I mean, those guys are just going to rock it. And that's why you have good counselors, so that when you're not able to, everything still moves. Yeah. Everything still goes as it
but
should.
But then here's her... It's
almost a testament to like how the church is organized and run.
I'm with you on that. I do think the final notes in the article are ones that cause one to take pause. Tells a story, I think, of her brother or something like that. Somebody she talked to, the author. And this individual says, well, I'm of the opinion that God could still direct the church through President Monson, even if he was mentally unwell. And then she says, but don't you need an elders quorum, President? Why don't you take, and she names a member of their ward with a severe mental disability. Like, why don't you suggest so-and-so to the stake? Why can't he be the elders quorum president? And the guy says, huh.
No. Well, this story is, so this is her husband she's talking to. And it's more the idea that God can reveal things through people that maybe don't have the mental capacity or faculties, right? And like, that's right. Not that I think she's using a poor example of what's being discussed. That's not the point here. I mean, like the expectation of God revealing his will through Thomas S. Monson. If he was like, hey, I think right now we should go through and bulldoze all the buildings and start over and build them like this. I think the brethren would probably be like, all right, hold on. We'll work on this. We'll do a feasibility assessment. We'll check it out and we'll go through it. Like, I don't think the expectation is that the church is still being completely run and dictated from the mouth of Thomas S. Monson in these moments. I wouldn't expect that.
And I think a lot of it shows that there's a contingency plan in place. There's a reason there are counselors and then the 12 apostles. There's a reason we have this structure so that the church can go on in the event that someone's ill and can't fulfill their duties.
Anyway.
Absolutely. Okay. I'm going to do another quick one right here. This is sad, but it's a wonderful gesture, I think. Of course, we've talked about the LDS family that was executed about a month ago in Texas. Remember that? So the one daughter who survived actually received a letter from J.K. Rowling, who wrote the Harry Potter books. There was a personalized letter with a quote from Dumbledore when it says, "Happiness can be found even in the darkest of times." But she sent a handwritten letter and wrote that out and then signed it Albus Dumbledore and sent it to her. That's just a very nice gesture, I think. Regardless of one's love of Harry Potter, because we all need...
No, mainly through your love of Harry
Potter. No, I think that's a pretty sweet thing to do no matter what. And it's a good, and it's a pretty good comment to remember that you can find happiness even in, heaven forbid, I can't imagine having everyone in your family murdered in front of you. That's the, one of the most unthinkable things that I could even try to fathom. But there's a way to get through everything, you know? And it's a good reminder because the atonement is always there and our Savior is always there for us to lean upon and rely on, even in the darkest of hours. That's all.
Sure. Let's... Sure. I like you, Jeff. That's why we're here. Let's see. There's the BYU. BYU is continuing to be the banner of Mormondom to the nation. They are the fourth least gay-friendly school, joining the ranks of the College of the Ozarks and Wake Forest and other such ridiculous places.
Pepperdine, though. That's interesting. Pepperdine.
Pepperdine.
Well, I just wouldn't think Pepperdine would be on this list. I mean, Pepperdine, I think, has religious roots, but you don't think of it being a any kind of a place that's hostile towards gays. I mean, it's in Malibu. It's, you know.
University of Mississippi finally made the list, too. So here's what's interesting about this to me. BYU, obviously very, very proud of its stone-cold, sober ranking all the time. They mentioned much less the fact that it's the fourth least friendly, gay-friendly school. It's a little bit, to kind of poke at BYU a little bit, it speaks to sort of the mentality or the priorities of that school, if I may. The idea that it's much more important to keep the, all these sort of structured honor code-esque rules that aren't so much, Christendom or even Mormondom. They're just manufactured, can't have a beard type rules, and we take a lot of pride in that. And we put less emphasis on maybe the loving or the being the kind of place where people feel welcomed and taken care of and supported. So
also Brigham Young moved up two spots. Last year it was ranked sixth. I would think we've gotten better at this, but in these rankings we've gone up two slots.
Well, that is better, Jeff. We've gotten better.
No, it means we're more unfriendly, which translates to less friendly.
Oh, it's just how you look at it. Is your glass half full or half empty? I don't know. Who's to say?
Yeah, I think it's we'll probably always be on those lists. It's almost funny that you consider us who we have a long way to go in having, especially working through gay issues within the church and with BYU culture and stuff. But at the same time, you would think we'd be more accepting and helpful than, I hate to pick on the Deep South, but then a lot of universities in the South that would...
University of Mississippi, we're looking at you.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think some of those would create much more hostile environments. But I guess the big difference is, bottom line, even though you can be gay and be a student at BYU, you cannot be, like, actively gay in the same sense at BYU. And so that changes it because I imagine you can be as gay as you want at Wake Forest and nothing's going to happen to you, at least as far as, academic punishment or your standing or anything like that. Whereas those things are in flux when you're at the Y.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jeff, get the next hard-hitting issue.
Okay. So a strip club advertised on a church building.
Hello. Yeah.
This happened.
That's a funny move.
This happened in the Bronx, up there in New York City, friends. So this is a projection-based advertisement. At first, it showed up on a Starbucks.
So it's guerrilla marketing.
Yep, and the Starbucks was like, hey, no, no. And now they broadcasted for a strip club called the Sin City Cabaret on a building that is owned by the church. They didn't say it was an actual church building, so I don't know what it might have been, but they said it was a building owned by the church.
Oh, that guerrilla marketing.
Yeah, and so I don't think people aren't happy about it in general because I think it's just a pleasantly chill residential area. So no one's even just saying, hey, Mormons don't like that. They're just saying, we don't want this in our neighborhood, period. But oh, the sweet irony. Imagine if you were getting out of a temple session in Manhattan across from the Lincoln Center. And then on the side wall of the church building, there...
It would be very upsetting,
there
Jeff.
It was.
Very
You'd
upsetting.
Be like, uh-huh. What?
So there's a, let's see, there's a BYU Idaho religion professor. And if I may, he teaches online religion. And if I may, he taught it for one semester almost all the way through.
And any other disclaimers
professor,
before we get
And he looks like Ruxin from the League. And his name is Kurt Cottle. And he was teaching this course and then he got fired from his job because he didn't teach the course as it was designed. He took liberties with it. And then he felt that because BYU Idaho had fired him, the church had fired him, and he was no longer going to be held in the bridle of the church. No, he said, the church will not have me. I will not have the church. He was sick of questions that ask, how can you be a member and then say XYZ? He says, now he's not a member. And no one can question him. He speaks only for himself.
Yeah. It's unfortunate because the
school said, we just want you to teach the curriculum, so shut your face.
Well, it's more that he went above and beyond the curriculum, I think. Because he taught the curriculum. But the curriculum for online courses at BYU Idaho, it's not developed by the teachers. The teacher is basically there just to push buttons and then grade papers. Not to actually do any teaching because it's just, you know, it's programs. And so he wanted to go beyond that and actually have Google Hangouts or office hours.
It was a little too ambitious. This happens in live professors as well.
So he wanted to do a lot of
stuff. They get a little too excited.
He did.
You got to fire
him. He did call into question the actual historic veracity of the story of Brigham Young's countenance changing to that of Joseph Smith.
I think that's the scapegoat. I doubt that's the actual issue.
But apparently people...
I think anybody would actually enter into dialogue around the historical veracity.
But you have to...
There's plenty of accounts to say it happened. There's plenty of accounts of people that didn't see it.
It's true.
So,
but what's also interesting is that this wasn't just BYU. His own bishop will not let him teach in his ward. So there's that too.
Again, if I may, you teach when you're called, and so I think the fact that he's pouting that he's not the gospel doctrine teacher, even though he's really smart, doesn't mean anything here. I think that's just a little presumptuous. I'm a great teacher. Why am I not teaching gospel doctrine? And why is Bozo up there? Wah,
I don't know. But like Al said, I think it's unfortunate because I think as a church, as a church schools, we should allow for open discussion about ideas and stuff, and that's fine.
I don't feel like this story says that we don't. I feel like the story says that Ruxin was pretty ticked off that
he wasn't it does,
chosen.
But I mean, you can tell that the people just basically told him, like, we just want you to teach the curriculum, which is fair.
Two sides to every story, Jeff.
It's fair.
All we've got is Ruxin's.
Because
side.
If you do any job, what you should do is do the job. Don't necessarily add to the,
do
job,
the job
or change the job.
Make the money. Don't let the money make
do
you.
Do the job you've been hired
change
to do.
Change the game. Don't let the game change you.
I just think it's sad that he feels like he has no place for him in the church because the school didn't want him back. That's unfortunate.
Yeah, that is,
sad.
Is sad.
Who does that? Al, do you think there's a stigma for returning missionaries who return early?
Yeah, you mean failures? Sure. No, I'm just kidding. There is mainly around elders that come home with back problems. Like, if you come home with back problems, we pretty much know that you just had sex.
Problems. That's the excuse.
Yeah, back problems, that's obviously sex. Obviously. I mean, something lighter, like, oh, you know, I had a really bad run with depression or something. That's probably legit. But back problems, that's code. That's missionary code for sex, for sure.
Okay. So outside of that, what about those who come home for legitimate reasons?
Such as?
Well, whatever. If it, say it really was.
What is a legitimate reason to not be serving Jesus?
Many. Physical incapacity, just like we talked about.
No, so I know what you're saying. I'm being a little bit facetious.
You know, what if you... Okay, so... Because I do think that in the church, unfortunately, even if someone comes back, like they might have had... Be going through having depression problems, and the only way to... I've had friends who have come home after a couple of months because they had...
Are you saying I've had friends in quotes? Are these real friends or are these just...
No, these are you. People I know. I served 2 full years. Entire years.
The best 8 months.
But anyway, you know, came home because depression resurfaced or whatever else. And it was difficult to work through. Best thing for them to do is to come home. And that's fine. But I do feel like naturally in our culture, we put a stigma on those things.
Well, let me give you the two sides. The one side, Jeff, is it's hard for everybody. And so the ones that in one respect, give up, right? The ones that give up, they should be seen as a little bit less than the ones that did not give up, right? I mean, it's sort of a band of brothers mentality for the ones that made it through 2 years in the cold, dirty Ukraine, right? Like, there's something to be said for that. In the same vein, the people, not, like, I feel the same way about missions as I do about college. Not everybody is made for it. And the fact that we expect everybody to be there is probably what gets us into a little bit more trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, there needs to be less... I think maybe less expectation on some of the up and comings, because I would rather, if you're not cut out for it, that you don't go. I mean, don't go and fail, right? Go with the intention and the expectation that you'll succeed. And a legit medical thing, you know, you get pancreatic failure, whatever gets you home. That's fine. Like, that's beyond your control. But if you get out there and it's just really hard, like that, let's try and avoid that. Let's try and pre-screen for that.
Or if it's just hard, and there is something to say for people who go like, oh man, this is harder than I thought it was going to be. I don't know if I want to be here. In that case, I say, buck up. It's hard for everybody. You're not the only one who enters the mission field and says, oh my goodness, what have I gotten myself into? This is crazy. Every single missionary thinks that at some point.
Continuing on though, good for us to kind of sit and pout when they get home and be like, oh, well, you were kind of a missionary. You didn't do a really good job. You know, like that needs to be, I mean, I guess that needs to just be them and like let it go. Like, because I don't want anybody to ever come up to me and be like, no, because you were a good missionary, I'm going to give you this thing or we're going to put you in this position. We're going to do this. No. Let's talk about how I am now. And what I'm doing now, and let's make decisions on that. So if you came home early, you know, don't worry about it. Just go live your life and be the best you can and do what you're going to do and trust that people are going to just be okay with it. As a 22-year-old trying to date, you're probably going to get the shaft a lot.
It's going to be hard because they want a return.
Yeah, they're going to be cheap. They're going to be crummy. But like, just hang in there. Dating as a 26-year-old, there's much less feeling for the garments. Dating as a 30-year-old... There's much less garments.
There you go. But we can do a lot as a culture to be more accommodating and not when missionaries come home to sing as if they're walking around with a scarlet letter on them. You know,
Jeff, I get such sweet satisfaction out of being better than them.
I know you do.
Why do we have to be Christian?
Al,
why do we have to love?
As not your Elders Quorum president, but as a Elders Quorum president, I counsel you to not strive to feel better. Schadenfreude never helped anyone. Never. I guess we got to go here in a few minutes because Al's got some things going on. A couple quick mentions, I guess, for us here.
Yeah.
All the missionaries serving that had been serving in the African countries of Sierra Leone and Liberia have all been reassigned because of the, if you've been following the news, there's been the massive Ebola outbreak in West Africa right
now. Hundreds dead already.
Big, big problem right now. So as a safety measure, missionaries are fine, but they're just...
Isn't this how Planet of the Apes started?
Basically, did you see Dawn of the Planet of the Apes yet?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't seen it. I also haven't seen Guardians of the Galaxy.
I am home.
So anyway, that's unfortunate. At least it's not because they're closing a mission because of civil unrest, like in Ukraine and other places. But hopefully they can sort this out and get the work going again. The church has seen great growth in Western Africa. So it's unfortunate if the missionaries have to leave because of a public health crisis, but a crisis.
Hopefully they'll be back
soon. A crisis is a crisis, and we got to react accordingly. Also, Elder Nelson will be speaking at BYU's commencement. So if you're graduating from BYU, or if you want to go see Elder Nelson, go to the Marriott Center on August 14th at 4 p.m. Hang out.
In our continued coverage Russell of the Mormon Bachelorette, if I may, Jeff.
You may.
The five contestants have been chosen. There's four, and then a surprise fifth. They chose five contestants.
Five bachelorettes.
They're just not patient enough. You got to take your time on this. They've got Katie Shaw, who's 25. Kristen Johnson, who's 38. She's almost 40. Mindy Leavitt, 27. Tiffany Freeze, who's 30. And Cassidy Baker, 30. This is an old crew. This is a lot of they're putting a lot on this. And in a very tacky way, they were all surprised at work or some other weird dog-infested home of theirs. And we look forward to mocking all the dates. We'll save our vitriol there are men.
I would like to read a YouTube comment, though, from Black Mormon. It says, one, Utah-centric. Two, doesn't represent MSA diversity in age and life circumstance. What is that?
Mid-single adult?
Yeah. Three, created extreme voter fatigue with so many surprise process changes along the way. Four, midstream website change created confusion. Five, poor production quality. Are you kidding? You used a cell phone to record the selection announcement. Six, inconsistency in rules. Host video said voting would continue through August 1st, but selections were made July 30th. What a joke. What's up, people?
You get them, buddy. You get them.
Oh, man. I can't wait to make
that. Sounds like you. Are you Black Mormon?
I wish. I wish. But
also, there was an update to the LDS Tools app that nobody cares about. It didn't change a thing.
Yeah, I'm good about that. We can leave it there. Also, the Matt Walsh blog. I'm tired of Matt Walsh. I'll just say that.
Jeff, you hate Matt Walsh. You talked about how he doesn't want to teach safe sex to his kids because there is no safe sex.
It's a fair point. He wants to teach abstinence, which is fine. But in the real world, in general, I think it's still good to teach about safe sex because kids...
I think sex education is good, but teaching abstinence is... Like, my mom... I think my mom did a great job where she's like, hey, this is going to be useful information for you someday. Here's how to put on a condom. And we had that talk, and we discussed it. It was fine, but it wasn't like, here's for when you decide that you're not going to keep the commandments and you want to do this real bad and you're super horny. It was, this is actually useful for you someday down the road. And it was, I mean, could not imagine a more weird scenario than getting that discussion from your mom.
Absolutely.
Because my dad just, he's not that kind of guy. But but we had the chat. And off it went. She was like, this is what's going on. And on your wedding night, I'll give you the full, like, pencil sketch drawing details. But for now, this is all you get. And I was like, whoo, all right. I'm never getting married. And that's probably why I'm still single again.
So
that's it, Jeff.
I'm tired of Matt Walsh, though.
Yeah.
Sick of him.
Okay. Anyway, I think what a delightful show. I've been very excited with this, Jeff. You've done a great job tonight.
Thank you. Very kind. I don't have much of a voice, though. I've had trouble talking today.
No, you're great.
Folks, go visit us on facebook.com/thisweekinmormons. We are called @TheRealTwim on Twitter. We're also on Instagram, where you can hang out with us there. And, please download this podcast and Sunday School Bonanza and Third Hour of Power, which go through gospel doctrine and Priesthood Relief Society lessons, respectively. And we appreciate if you share those and, you know, leave us a nice little note. Let us know how we're doing.
Yeah, and you can, email us. Contact This Week in Mormons. You already say that?
Yeah, but say it again. We love your email.
Just keep emailing us, and we love you. Everybody, have a great week. Jeff, you're delightful. Thanks for being here with me, buddy. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, folks, this has been This Week in Mormons. Visit us at thisweekinmormons.com. We hope you have a great week. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.